Book 12. We are in Paradise Lost, John Milton's Paradise Lost, Book 12, our final book. The Argument. The angel Michael continues from the flood to relate what shall succeed. Then, in the mention of Abraham, comes by degrees to explain who that seed of the woman shall be, which was promised Adam and Eve in the fall, his incarnation, death, resurrection, and ascension, the state of the church till his second coming. Adam, greatly satisfied and recomforted by these relations and promises, descends the hill with Michael, awakens Eve, who all this while had slept, but with gentle dreams, composed to quietness of mind and submission. Michael, in either hand, leads them out of paradise, the fiery sword waving behind them, and the cherubim taking their stations to guard the place. And, of course, that's how the book will end. Line 1, Book 12. As one who in his journey baits at noon, though bent on speed, so here the archangel paused betwixt the world destroyed and world restored. If Adam ought perhaps might interpose, then with transmission sweet, new speech resumes. Line 5. So Michael says to Adam, thus thou hast seen one world begin and end, and man as from a second stock proceed. Much thou hast yet to see, but I perceive thy mortal sight to fail. Objects divine must needs impair and weary human sense. Henceforth, what is to come I will relate. Thou therefore give due audience and attend. So I'm going to tell you now. This second source of men, while yet but few, and while the dread of judgment past remains fresh in their minds, fearing the deity, with some regard to what is just and right, in other words, immediately following the flood, men are pious or religious or obedient, living with some regard to what is just and right, line 16, shall lead their lives and multiply apace, laboring the soil and reaping plenteous crop, corn, wine, and oil, and from the herd or flock, oft sacrificing bullock, lamb, or kid, with large wine offerings poured and sacred feast, line 21, shall spend their days in joy unblamed, and dwell long time in peace by families and tribes under paternal rule. And, of course, this is the time of the patriarchs. Till one shall rise of proud, ambitious heart. Now, I will tell you that this person who's going to rise, this one who shall rise in line 24, is Nimrod. Nimrod can be traced through the biblical narrative from Genesis 10:8, and there's one other verse. I'll have to look it up. Nimrod went out and first begun at Babylon and was started the Babylonians. And then from him also proceeded into Assyria, and it is from Nimrod that the Assyrians come. If you don't know your Old Testament history, first of all, shame on you, but ask me, and I'll gladly teach it to you very quickly. I can teach it to you in an hour, your Old Testament history. Nimrod started the Babylonians, then the Assyrians. The Assyrians are those terrible people who were ruling during the time of, for example, Jonah, the prophet Jonah. It was to Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, that Jonah was sent to, which was like sending a Jew into World War II, into Germany with Adolf Hitler, and having a Jew tell Adolf Hitler to repent. That's what it was like when God told Jonah to go to Nineveh. It was the capital of Assyria. If you do any Assyrian studies of Assyrian archaeology, you know that Assyria is the country that thought up all of the most ghastly atrocities, most ghastly methods of torture for their prisoners. They were the people that skinned people alive, that impaled people, that put hooks in their mouths. They are the people that would take a conquered king and put hooks in his nose and mouth so they could hold him, put him on the ground on his knees, force him to watch all of his sons being slaughtered, and then put out his eyes and make him a slave, or then kill him. So the last thing he sees is the murder of his children. Nimrod is the author or the patriarch of the Babylonians and the Assyrians. And this is who Michael is now telling Adam about. Under paternal rule, till one shall rise of proud, ambitious heart. who not content, line 25, with fair equality, fraternal state, will arrogant dominion undeserved over his brethren, and quite dispossess concord and law of nature from the earth. Hunting and men, not beasts, shall be his game. With war and hostile snare such as refuse subjection to his empire, Tyrannus, a mighty hunter hence he shall be styled before the Lord, as in despite of heaven, or from heaven claiming second sovereignty, line 35, or he may claim second sovereignty from heaven, he may claim he himself comes from heaven. And there are those who equate the Greek hero Heracles with Nimrod, that Heracles could be a memory of Nimrod. And you know how it goes in generation to generation, that all of your exploits get exaggerated and added to till you get from Nimrod to Heracles. And this makes a lot of sense. It's a possible. Or from heaven claiming second sovereignty, and from rebellion shall derive his name, though of rebellion others he accuse. He with a crew, whom like ambition joins with him or under him to tyrannize, marching from Eden towards the west, shall find the plain, wherein a black bituminous gurge boils out from underground, the mouth of hell. Of brick and of that stuff they cast to build a city and a tower. This is Babylon and the Tower of Babel. A tower whose top may reach to heaven, and get themselves a name, line 45, lest far dispersed in foreign lands their memory be lost, regardless whether good or evil fame. But God, who oft descends to visit men unseen, and through their habitations walks to mark their doings, them beholding soon comes down to see their city, ere the tower obstruct heaven towers, and in derision sets upon their tongues a various spirit to raise quite out their native language. So he removes their native languages so that they don't know how to understand one another, and instead to sow a jangling noise of words unknown, line 55. Forthwith a hideous gabble rises loud among the builders, each to others calls not understood, till hoarse, and all in rage. As mocked they storm, great laughter was in heaven, and looking down, to see the hubbub strange and hear the din. Thus was the building left ridiculous, and the work confusion named, or Babel. Whereto thus Adam fatherly displeased, "Oh, execrable son, so to aspire above his brethren, to himself assuming authority usurped, from God not given. He gave us only over beast, fish, fowl dominion absolute. That right we hold by his donation, but man over men he made not lord, such title to himself reserving, human left from human free." Here we have Milton's Politics in lines 69, 70, and 71. It is hard to say who Milton is talking about. Is he talking about Cromwell? Is he talking about Charles II? Who is he talking about? But obviously he does not approve of a monarchy. "But man over men he made not lord, such title to himself reserving, king, human left from human free. But this usurper, his encroachment proud, stays not on man. To God his tower intends, siege and defiance. Wretched man!" So Milton's writing his narrative as though Adam, the very first man, is looking forward in history and saying, "Oh my goodness, this is awful. What food will he convey up hither to sustain himself and his rash army, where thin air above the clouds will pine his entrails gross, and famish him of breath, if not of bread?" To whom thus Michael? So Michael replies to Adam, "Justly thou abhorrest that, son, who on the quiet state of men such trouble brought, affecting to subdue rational liberty, yet know withal, since thy original lapse, true liberty is lost, which always with right reason dwells twinned, and from her hath no individual being," line 85, "reason in man obscured, or not obeyed, immediately inordinate desires and upstart passions catch the government from reason, and to servitude reduce man till then free." And so he's saying, since you sinned, Adam, true liberty is lost. And that it always dwells with right reason, but that is never going to be found in one individual person, because reason in man gets obscured or not obeyed, and inordinate desires and upstart passions take you from reason when you're king. Line 90, Therefore, since he permits within himself unworthy powers to reign over free reason, God in judgment just subjects him from without to violent lords, who oft as undeservedly enthrall, or would be to capture, to subject him, put him into slavery, enthrall his outward freedom. Tyranny must be, line 95, though to the tyrant thereby no excuse. Yet sometimes nations will decline so low from virtue, which is reason, that no wrong but justice and some fatal curse annexed drives them out of their outward liberty, their inward lost. Witness the irreverent son of him who built the ark, who, for the shame done to his father, heard his heavy curse, servant of servants on his vicious race. This will the latter, as the former world, still tend from bad to worse, till God at last, wearied with their iniquities, withdraw his presence from among them, and avert his holy eyes, resolving from henceforth to leave them to their own polluted ways. And one peculiar nation, this is King James' use of the English, in line 111, God's people were called in the King James Version of the Bible a peculiar people, and it meant a special people in the 1600s. That word has taken on a little bit of a negative or an odd connotation now, but at this time, a peculiar nation is a special nation, to select from all the rest, of whom to be invoked a nation from one faithful man to spring. And, of course, who could that be? That's going to be Abraham. He's going to select one. And make them of them a peculiar people, a special nation. Line 113. Him on this side, Euphrates, yet residing, bred up in idol worship, because Abraham is bred up in in idol worship, and then God calls him out of that. Oh, that man, canst thou believe, should be so stupid grown, while yet the patriarch live, who scraped the flood, as to forsake the living God, and fall to worship their own work in wood and stone, for gods, yet him God the Most High vouchsafest to call by vision from his father's house, his kindred and false gods, into a land which he will show him, and from him will raise a mighty nation. And these, of course, are all the promises in Genesis 12. I hope that's in Genesis 12. And upon him shower his benediction so, that in his seed all nations shall be blessed. And that, of course, is straight out of the Bible. Let me see if we have a footnote for that. We should. Genesis 11 and Genesis 12. Yes, the promises of a land and a people and a throne. Let's see. And from him will raise a mighty nation, and upon him shower his benediction so, that in his seed all nations shall be blessed. He straight obeys, not knowing to what land, yet firm believes, because Abraham leaves and goes to serve. I see him, but thou canst not. With what faith he leaves his gods, his friends, and native soil, Ur of Chaldea, passing now the ford to Haran, and after him a cumbrous train of herds and flocks and numerous servitude, not wandering poor, but trusting all his wealth with God, who called him in a land unknown. Canaan he now attends. I see his tents pitched about Shechem, and the neighboring plain of Morah, where there by promise he receives gift to his progeny of all that land, from Hamath norward to the desert south, things by their names I call, yet though yet unnamed. I'm calling things by their names, Adam, even though they're not named yet. Line 140. From Hermon east to the great western sea, Mount Hermon, yonder sea, each place, behold in prospect as I point them. On the shore, Mount Carmel, here the double-founted stream Jordan, true limit eastward, but his sons shall dwell to Senir, that long ridge of hills. This ponder, that all nations of the earth shall in his seed be blessed. By that seed is meant thy great deliverer, who shall bruise the serpent's head, whereof to thee anon plainer shall be revealed. This patriarch blessed, whom faithful Abraham due time shall call a son, and of his son a grandchild leaves, like him in faith, in wisdom, and renown. The grandchild with 12 sons increased departs from Canaan. And so that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 tribes, and he's renamed as Israel. And he departs from Canaan to a land hereafter called Egypt, because they go into captivity in Egypt, divided by the river Nile. See where it flows, disgorging at 7 mouths into the sea. It to sojourn in that land he comes invited by a younger son in time of dearth. In the time of Remember, they go to Egypt in the time of drought and starvation. Line 161. A son whose worthy deeds raise him to be the second in that realm of Pharaoh, Joseph. There he dies and leaves his race growing into a nation, and now grown suspected to a sequent king. Remember, there came a king who did not know Joseph, who seeks to stop their overgrowth, because there's too many Hebrews, as inmate guests too numerous. So Adam is foreseeing now, he sees the Egyptian slavery. Whence of guests, he makes them slaves inhospitably, and kills their infant males, till by two brethren, these two brethren call Moses and Aaron, sent from God to claim his people from enthrallment, from slavery, they return with glory and spoil back to their promised land. That's the Exodus, in Exodus 12. But first, the lawless tyrant, who denies to know their God or message to regard, and this is Pharaoh, must be compelled by signs and judgment dire, line 175. To blood unshed, the rivers must be turned. Frogs, lice, and flies must all his palace fill with loathed intrusion, and fill all the land. His cattle must of rot and murrain die. Botches and blains must all his flesh emboss, and all his people, thunder mixed with hail, hail mixed with fire, must rend the Egyptian sky and wheel on the earth, devouring where it rolls, what it devours not, herb or fruit or grain, a darksome cloud of locusts swarming down must eat. These are those 10 plagues. And on the ground leave nothing green. Darkness must overshadow all his bounds, palpable darkness, and blot out 3 days. Last, with one midnight stroke, all the firstborn of Egypt must lie dead. Thus, with 10 wounds, line 190, the river dragon tamed at length submits to let his sojourners depart, and oft humbles his stubborn heart, but still as ice, more hardened after thaw, till in his rage pursuing whom he late dismissed, the sea swallows him with his host. But them lets pass as on dry land, between two crystal walls, awed by the rod of Moses, so to stand divided. This is crossing the Red Sea. Divided till his rescued gain their shore. Such wondrous power God to his saint will lend, though present in his angel, who shall go before them in a cloud and pillar of fire, by day a cloud, by night a pillar of fire, to guide them in their journey and remove behind them, while the obdurate king pursues. Line 205. All night he will pursue, Pharaoh, but his approach darkness defends between till morning watch. Then, through the fiery pillar and the cloud, God looking forth, will trouble all his host and craze their chariot wheels. When by command Moses once more his potent rod extends over the sea his rod obeys. On their embattled ranks the waves return and overwhelm their war. The race elect safe towards Canaan from the shore advance through the wild desert. Not the readiest way, lest entering on the Canaanite alarmed war terrify them inexpert. Okay, they don't go right into Canaan, they're not ready for war. And fear return them back to Egypt, choosing rather inglorious life with servitude, for life to noble and innoble is more sweet, untrained in arms, where rashness leads not on. Line 219 to 222 is another example where Milton compares, in a type of analogy, the English people to the Israelite people. Many of the English Puritans compared the English people, the Puritans especially, to the Israelites going into a promised land. And this was, American Puritans did that too, going into a promised land, and they looked at themselves as God's chosen, and they were so thrilled with this interregnum of 1649 to 1660 that this was their promised land. They were given to this. And he throws this in, talking about the Israelites, but also talking about the English who begged for their king to come back. Now let me read 219 to 223 again. Choosing rather inglorious life with servitude, for life to noble and innoble is more sweet, untrained in arms. Life in servitude is more sweet to those who don't know how to do battle, where rashness leads not on. This also shall they gain by their delay in the wide wilderness. There they shall found their government. Okay, they're also going to gain this by their 40 years in the wilderness. They're going to establish a government. Right? Because Moses will not be able to govern. His father-in-law Jethro will set him up with judges between groups of, I don't know, 70 or 100 or something, And of course, this balanced government that is set up there, the English will later choose to base their law on all of this government that's set up in Deuteronomy. And then, of course, American law is based on English law. It's actually very remarkable. Line 225, they will found their government, and their great Senate choose through the 12 tribes to rule by laws ordained. God from the Mount of Sinai, whose gray top shall tremble, he descending will himself in thunder, lightning, and loud trumpet sound ordain them laws. This is giving the law, the Ten Commandments. Part such as appertain to civil justice, part religious rites of sacrifice, informing them by types and shadows of that destined seed to bruise the serpent, by what means he shall achieve man's deliverance. But the voice of God to mortal ear is dreadful. They beseech that Moses might report to them his will, and terror cease. He grants what they besought, instructed that to God is no access without mediator, whose high office now Moses in figure bears, to introduce one greater, of whose day he shall foretell, and all the prophets in their age, the times of great Messiah shall sing. Thus laws and rites established, such delight hath God in men, line 245, who are obedient to his will, that he vouchsafes, he promises, among them to set up his tabernacle, the Holy One with mortal men to dwell. By his prescript a sanctuary is framed, of cedar overlaid with gold, therein an ark, and in the ark his testimony. This, of course, is the Ark of the Covenant, line 251. His testimony, the records of his covenant, over these a mercy seat of gold, between the wings of two bright cherubim. Before him burn seven lamps, as in a zodiac representing the heavenly fires. Over the tent a cloud shall rest by day, a fiery gleam by night, save when they journey, except when they journey, and at length they come, conducted by his angel, to the land promised to Abraham and his seed. The rest, line 260, were long to tell. How many battles fought, how many kings destroyed and kingdoms won, or how the sun shall in mid-heaven stand still a day entire, and night's due course adjourn, man's voice commanding, sun in Gibeon stand, and thou moon in the vale of Aelon, till Israel overcome. So call the third from Abraham, son of Isaac, and from him his whole descent, who thus shall Canaan win. And so the angel gets rather brief as he finishes up telling the entire story of the Old Testament, says, and so says, call the third from Abraham, son of Isaac, and from him, of course, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, who becomes Israel, and from him his whole descent, the 12 tribes who shall Canaan win. Line 270. Here Adam, okay, interposed. So Adam interrupts. O sent from heaven, enlightener of my darkness, gracious things thou hast revealed, those chiefly which concern just Abraham and his seed. Now first I find my eyes true opening, and my heart much eased, erewhile perplexed with thoughts, what would become of me and all mankind. But now I see his day, in whom all nations shall be blessed, favor unmerited by me, who sought forbidden knowledge by forbidden means. This yet I apprehend or understand not, why to those among whom God will deign to dwell on earth so many and so various laws are given. So many laws argue so many sins among them. How can God with such reside? To whom thus Michael? So he says to Adam, doubt not, but that sin will reign among them, as of thee begot. Okay, as they are going to get from you. And therefore was law given them to evince their natural pravity. Okay, so the purpose of the law, this is the purpose of the law, is to lead you toward grace and mercy, to lead you toward God. It cannot cure you, it cannot make you holy, but the law is a tutor. By stirring up sin against law to fight, that when they see, law can discover sin, but not remove. Okay, so law can tell you what sin is. Do not kill. If there's a law, do not kill, it's discovering, it's putting light on sin. But law will not remove sin. Law can discover sin, but not remove, line 290. Save by those shadowy expiations weak, the blood of bulls and goats, they may conclude some blood more precious must be paid for man. Okay, more precious blood. This is a foreshadowing. More precious blood than that of bulls and goats is going to have to be paid for man. Just for unjust. just blood will have to be shed for unjust blood, that in such righteousness to them by faith imputed they may find justification towards God, and peace of conscience, which the law, by ceremonies, cannot appease, nor man the moral part perform, and not performing cannot live. So law appears imperfect, and but given with purpose to resign them in full time up to a better covenant, disciplined from shadowy types to truth, from flesh to spirit, from imposition of strict laws to free acceptance of large grace, from servile fear to filial, works of law to works of faith. And therefore shall not Moses, though of God highly beloved, being but the minister of law, his people into Canaan lead. Moses will not be able to lead them into Canaan. But Joshua, whom the Gentiles Jesus call, line 310, his name and office bearing, who shall quell the adversary serpent and bring back through the world's wilderness long-wandered man safe to eternal paradise of rest. Meanwhile, they in their earthly Canaan, placed long time, shall dwell and prosper. But when sins national interrupt their public peace, provoking God to raise them enemies, from whom as oft he saves them penitent, by judges first and then under kings, of whom the second, both for piety renowned and puissant deeds, strong and mighty deeds, a promise shall receive irrevocable. And this is the Davidic covenant from 2 Samuel 7:16. First he saves them penitent by judges, then under kings, and under the second, under the kings, both for piety renowned, for holiness renowned, and for strong and mighty deeds, King David, a promise shall receive irrevocable, that someone on his throne will reign forever, that his regal throne forever shall endure. The like shall sing all prophecy, that of the royal stock of David, so I name this king, shall rise a son, the woman's seed to thee foretold. Okay, because Christ will come from the house of David. Foretold to Abraham, as in whom shall trust all nations, and to kings foretold, of kings the last, for of his reign shall be no end. Line 330. But first, a long succession must ensue, and his next son, for wealth and wisdom feigned, this is Solomon, the clouded ark of God, till then in tents wandering, okay, until Solomon. Solomon built the temple about 1000 B.C., and until then, the ark of God had wandered around in tents. The Exodus was about 1446 B.C., and they built the tabernacle, they built all the implements and everything, they wandered around, really amazing. There was no temple until about 1000 B.C. when Solomon built the temple. He would not allow David to build it, remember? The clouded ark of God, till then in tents wandering, shall in a glorious temple enshrine such follow him as shall be registered, part good, part bad, of bad the longer scroll. Okay, so those that follow him, because after Solomon, we have the divided kingdom. In 931, we only have David, Saul, David, and Solomon. Then we have the divided kingdom. So by 931, we have a divided kingdom with Rehoboam and Jeroboam, the two sons of Solomon. So we have Judah and Israel, a northern Israel and a southern Israel that we call Judah. And so, in glorious temple enshrined, such follow him, those that follow him, line 335, as shall be registered, those that follow him, most of the southern kings, part good, the northern kings, part bad, of bad the longer scroll, most of the kings were bad, whose foul idolatries and other faults heaped to the popular sum will so incense God as to leave them and expose their land, their city, his temple, and his holy ark with all his sacred things, a scorn and prey to that proud city whose high walls thou sawest left in confusion, Babylon hence called. There in captivity he lets them dwell, and so he's talking about the Babylonian captivity, the space of 70 years, line 345, because the Babylonians, of course, in 586 then come down and destroy Jerusalem and begin taking out captives, and they take them to Babylon, and that, of course, is where Ezekiel went, that's where Daniel went. They take all the rich and famous first, and then under Cyrus, then when Babylon fell as a world power and the Persians rose in power, then Cyrus, one of the Persian kings, allowed Ezra and Nehemiah to come back and rebuild, and even rebuild a temple, that second temple. So he, line 3, 4, 5 says, after they're in Babylon, the space of 70 years, that's the Babylonian captivity, then brings them back, remembering mercy and his covenant sworn to David, established as the days of heaven. Returned from Babylon by leave of kings, their lords, whom God disposed, the house of God, they first re-edify. So first they're going to build the house of God, build the temple. This is Ezra and Nehemiah rebuilding the temple. And for a while, in mean estate, live moderate. For a while, they live okay. Till grown in wealth and multitude, factious they grow. But first among the priests, dissension springs. Men who attend the altar and should most endeavor peace. Their strife, pollution brings upon the temple itself. At last, they seize the scepter and regard not David's sons, then lose it to a stranger, that the true anointed king Messiah might be born, barred of his right. Yet at his birth a star unseen before in heaven proclaims him come, this is the birth of Christ, and guides the eastern sages, the Magi, who inquire his place to offer incense, myrrh, and gold. His place of birth a solemn angel tells to simple shepherds, keeping watch by night, line 365. They gladly hither haste, and by a choir of squadroned angels hear his carol sung. A virgin is his mother, but his sire the power of the Most High. He shall ascend the throne hereditary, and bound his reign, line 370, with earth's wide bounds, his glory with the heavens. He ceased, discerning Adam with such joy surcharged, as had like grief been dewed in tears. So Michael quits talking, and he notices that Adam has as much joy now as he had grief with the prior vision, without the vent of words with which these he breathed. And Adam is speaking now, line 375, O prophet of glad tidings, finisher of utmost hope, now clear I understand what oft my steadiest thoughts have searched in vain, why our great expectation should be called the seed of woman, virgin mother, hail, high in the love of heaven. Yet from my loins, line 380, thou shalt proceed, and from thy womb the Son of God Most High. So God with man unites. Needs must the serpent now his capital bruise expect with mortal pain. Say where and when their fight. What stroke shall bruise the victor's heel? Line 385. So Adam now is understanding the part of their curse that earlier was just not understandable to him. Now that he has seen all of biblical history, he's understanding. So he wants to see that final bit when the what stroke is going to bruise the victor's heel. Line 385. To whom thus Michael, so Michael speaks, dream not of their fight as of a duel or the local wounds of head or heel. Don't think it's a real head or a real heel. Not therefore joins the son manhood to Godhead with more strength to foil thy enemy, nor so is overcome Satan, whose fall from heaven, a deadlier bruise, disabled not to give thee thy death's wound, which he who comes thy Savior shall recur. Not by destroying Satan, but his works in thee and in thy seed, nor can this be, but by fulfilling that which thou didst want, that which you lacked, obedience to the law of God, imposed on penalty of death and suffering death, the penalty to thy transgression due. Here in lines 396, 7, and 8, and 9, Michael says, don't get too excited. Jesus is going to do what you could not do, that which you didst want, that which you didst lack, obedience to the law of God, imposed on penalty of death and suffering death, the penalty to thy transgression, sin, due, and due to theirs which out of thine will grow. So only can high justice rest upaid. The law of God exact he shall fulfill both by obedience and by love. Though love alone fulfill the law, thy punishment he shall endure by coming in the flesh. This is line 405. By coming in the flesh to a reproachful life and cursed death, proclaiming life to all who shall believe in his redemption, and that his obedience imputed becomes theirs by faith. His merits to save them, not their own, though legal works, for this he shall live hated, be blasphemed, seized on by force, judged, and to death condemned, a shameful and accursed, nailed to the cross by his own nation, slain for bringing life, but to the cross he nails thy enemies. the law that is against thee, and the sins of all mankind with him there crucified, never to hurt them more who rightly trust in this his satisfaction. So he dies, but soon revives. Death over him no power shall long usurp. Ere the third dawning light return, the stars of morn shall see him rise out of his grave, fresh as the dawning light, thy ransom paid, which man from death redeems, his death for man, as many as offered life neglect not. Line 425. So as many as he offers life to, that, and they don't neglect that, he will give this to them. And the benefit embrace by faith not void of works. This godlike act annuls thy doom. The death thou shouldst have died. In sin, forever lost from life. This act shall bruise the head of Satan, crush his strength, line 430, defeating sin and death, his two main arms, and fix far deeper in his head their stings, than temporal death shall bruise the victor's heel, or theirs whom he redeems, a death-like sleep, a gentle wafting to immortal life. Now, this, again, is his belief that those who die are kind of asleep, unknowing, line 435. Nor after resurrection shall he stay longer on earth than certain times to appear to his disciples, men who in his life still followed him. To them shall leave in charge to teach all nations what of him they learned and his salvation. This is that first part of Acts chapter 1 where Jesus is for 40 days teaching the disciples about the things of God. And his salvation, them who shall believe, baptizing in the profluent stream, the sign of washing them from guilt of sin to life pure, and in mind prepared, if so befall, for death, like that which the Redeemer died. All nations they shall teach, line 445. For from that day not only to the sons of Abraham's loins salvation shall be preached, but to the sons of Abraham's faith, wherever through the world, so in his seed all nations shall be blessed, line 450. Then to the heaven of heavens he shall ascend with victory, triumphing through the air over his foes and thine. There shall surprise the serpent, prince of air, and drag in chains through all his realm, and there confounded leave. Then enter into glory, and resume his seat at God's right hand, exalted high above all names in heaven. And hence shall come, when this world's dissolution shall be ripe, with glory and power to judge both quick and dead. Line 460. To judge the unfaithful dead, but to reward his faithful, and receive them into bliss, whether in heaven or earth. For then the earth shall all be paradise, far happier place than this of Eden, and far happier days. So spake the archangel Michael, then paused, as at the world's greatest period. I like that, the world's greatest period. And our sire, replete with joy and wonder, thus replied, O goodness infinite, goodness immense, that all this good of evil shall produce, and evil turn to good, more wonderful than that which by creation first brought forth light out of darkness. Full of doubt I stand, whether I should repent me now of sin by me done and occasioned, or rejoice much more, that much more good thereof shall spring to God more glory. These are unusual lines for 7:3 to 4:7-6, because what Adam is saying is, maybe it's better that I sinned. Much ink has been spilled on this topic. Is Milton trying to say that it is better that Adam sinned? Much ink has been spilled. People have spent entire careers writing books about this. On 476, that much good shall spring to God more glory, more good will to men from God, and over wrath grace shall abound. But say, if our deliverer up to heaven must reascend, what will betide the few his faithful left among the unfaithful herd, the enemies of truth, who then shall guide his people, who defend? Will they not deal worse with his followers than with him they dealt? Be sure they will, said the angel. But from heaven, line 485, he to his own a comforter will send, the promise of the Father, who shall dwell his spirit within them, and the law of faith, working through love, upon their hearts shall write, to guide them in all truth, and also arm with spiritual armor, able to resist Satan's assaults and quench his fiery darts. What man can do against them, not afraid, though to the death, against such cruelties, with inward consolations recompensed, and oft-supported, so as shall amaze their proudest persecutors. For the Spirit poured first on his apostles, whom he sends to evangelize the nations, nations, then on all baptized, that shall them with wondrous gifts endue to speak all tongues and do all miracles, as did their Lord before them. Thus they win great numbers of each nation to receive with joy the tidings brought from heaven. At length their ministry performed, and race well run, their doctrine and their story written left, they die. But in their room, as they forewarn, wolves shall succeed for teachers. Okay, after the original apostles die. Grievous wolves, who all the sacred mysteries of heaven to their own vile advantages shall turn of lucre, riches and money, and ambition, and the truth with superstitions and traditions taint. Now, when we're talking about here in line 5:10 and 5:11, superstitions and traditions taint, we're not just looking at the earliest heretics, because superstitions and traditions, those are words that in the 1600s point directly at Catholics. Left only in those written records pure, okay? Only Milton is saying sola scriptura, scripture alone. No traditions, no church traditions. And of course, the Catholic Church is a three-legged school, and traditions are very much part of theology. And for a Puritan, that is not, that's not possible. He says, only in the written records pure, only in the scriptures, though not but by the Spirit understood. Then shall they seek to avail themselves of names, line 515, places and titles, and with these to join secular power. Now, talking about secular power, joining with church power, he may be talking about the Church of England, or he may be talking about papal power, the power of the Pope. Difficult, whatever it is, they are darts. Though feigning, pretending, still to act by spiritual, to themselves appropriating the Spirit of God, promised alike and given to all believers, and from that pretense spiritual laws by carnal power shall force on every conscience laws which none shall find left them enrolled, or what the Spirit within shall on the heart engrave. What will they then but force the Spirit of grace itself, and bind, line 525, his consort liberty? What but unbuild his living temples, built by faith to stand, their own faith, not another's? For on earth, who against faith and conscience can be heard infallible? Yet many will presume, line 530, whence heavy persecution shall arise on all who in the worship persevere of spirit and truth. The rest, far greater part, will deem in outward rites and specious forms religion satisfied. So Milton here is having Michael, the angel, predict. That's really safe for Milton. He can't be hung for this, because Michael, an angel, is saying it. So Milton says, through Michael, the angel, that some, through outward rites and specious forms, religion satisfied. In other words, here in line 534 and 535, some will think that if they just do these things, go through the motions, they will satisfy religion. They're okay. They've taken care of it. Truth shall retire, bestuck with slanderous darts, and works of faith rarely be found. So shall the world go on, to good malignant, to bad men benign, under her own weight groaning, till the day appear of respiration to the just, and vengeance to the wicked, at return of him so lately promised to thy aid, the woman's seed. Obscurely then foretold, now amplier known, thy Savior and thy Lord, last in the clouds from heaven to be revealed in glory of the Father, to dissolve Satan with his perverted world, then raise from the conflagrant mass, purged and refined, new heavens, new earth, ages of endless date, founded in righteousness and peace of love, to bring forth fruits, joy, and eternal bliss. That's 551. He ended, and thus Adam thus replied, how soon hath thy prediction, seer blessed, measured this transient world, the race of time, the till time stand fixed? Beyond is all abyss, eternity, whose end no eye can reach. Greatly instructed, I shall hence depart. Okay, I've really got a good lesson today. Greatly in peace of thought, and have my fill of knowledge what this vessel can contain. Okay, I can hardly remember it all. Beyond which was my folly to aspire. I should never have asked to know more than this, line 560. Henceforth, I learn that, and here is Milton's, Adam is summarizing everything that he has just learned from the angel, how he now knows he's going to live. And so this is Milton, through Adam, telling us how a man should live. Henceforth I learn that to obey is best, and love with fear the only God, to walk as in his presence, ever to observe his providence, and on him sole depend, merciful over all his works, with good still overcoming evil, and by small accomplishing great things, by things deemed weak, subverting worldly strong, and worldly wise by simply meek, that suffering for truth's sake is fortitude to highest victory, and to the faithful death the gate of life. Taught this by his example, whom I now acknowledge, my Redeemer ever blessed. These are really some beautiful lines here in Book 12, line 561 to 573, I think, because Milton is saying that a simple life of obedience is best. If you look back through just these few lines, there is a lot of really nice truth here. It's almost a proverb that to obey and to love with fear, which is an awesome respect, to have an awesome respect for God, to walk just like you are in his presence, because you are, but to acknowledge that, to observe his providence, so whatever happens, you look and acknowledge what he's given you. You know, you wreck your car, your son wrecks your car, and you say, thank goodness you are safe. You don't say, oh, you wrecked the car. You say, thank goodness you are safe. You look at the glass that is half empty, but you see it half full. To walk, to observe his providence, and on him soul depend on God for everything, merciful over all his works, and overcome good with evil, by doing any small thing, day by day, small good things, realizing you'll accomplish great things, and that would be by things that were considered to be weak. Really amazing, suffering for truth's sake, fortitude to highest victory, and to the faithful death is the gate of life. Some beautiful lines. To whom thus also the angel that last replied, this having learnt, thou hast attained the sum of wisdom. Hope no higher, though all the stars thou knewest by name, and all the ethereal powers, all secrets of the deep, all nature's works, or works of God in heaven, air, earth, or sea, and all the riches of this world enjoyest, and all the rule, one empire, only add deeds to thy knowledge answerable, add faith, add virtue, patience, temperance, add love, by name to come called charity, the soul of all the rest, then wilt thou not be loath to leave this paradise, line 585, but shalt possess a paradise within thee, happier far. Let us descend now, therefore, from this top of speculation, for the hour precise exacts our parting hence, and see the guards, line 590, by me encamped on yonder hill, expect their motion, at whose fount a flaming sword, in signal of remove, waves fiercely round. So do you see those guards with the flaming swords? That's their signal. In signal of remove, waves fiercely round. We may no longer stay. Go, waken Eve. Her also I with gentle dreams have calmed, portending good, and all her spirits composed to meek submission. It's almost like he's drugged her so she won't get up and be all excited. She had dreams of this, and her spirits have been composed to meek submission. Maybe she's had a pill. Thou at season fit, let her with thee partake what thou hast heard. Okay, when you think it's right, tell her what I told you. Chiefly, what may concern her faith to know, the great deliverance by her seed to come, line 600. For by the woman's seed on all mankind, that ye may live, which will be many days, both in one faith unanimous, though sad, with cause for evils past, yet much more cheered with meditation, on the happy end. He ended, and they both descend the hill. Descended, Adam to the bower where Eve lay sleeping, ran before, but found her waked, and thus with words not sad she received him. Eve to Adam, oh, whence thou returnest, and whither wentest, I know, she says in line 610, for God is also in sleep, and dreams advise, which he hath sent propitious, some great good prophesying, since with sorrow and heart's distress wearied I fell asleep, but now lead on. In me is no delay. With thee to go is to stay here. Without thee here to stay is to go hence unwilling. Thou to me art all things under heaven. All places thou, who for my willful crime art banished hence. This further consolation, yet secure, I carry hence, though all by me is lost, such favor I worthy am vouchsafed. By me the promised seed shall all restore. So spake our mother Eve, and Adam heard well pleased, but answered not, for now too nigh the archangel stood, and from the other hill to their fixed station, all in bright array the cherubim descended, on the ground glittering meteorous, like meteors. As, what was it like? How shiny were they? A Homeric simile. As evening mist, risen from a river over the marish glides and gathers round, fast at the laborer's heel, homeward returning, high in front advanced, the brandished sword of God before them blazed, fierce as a comet, which with torrid heat and vapor as the Libyan air adust, began to parch that temperate clime, whereat in either hand the hastening angel caught our lingering parents, and to the eastern gate led them direct, and down the cliff as fast to the subjected plain, line 640, then disappeared. They, looking back, all the eastern side beheld of paradise, so late their happy seat, so lately their happy home, waved over by that flaming brand, the gate with dreadful faces thronged and fiery arms. Some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. The end.